This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Sean Lay. A ceasefire came into force in Gaza on Sunday. Temporary, perhaps, but for now it is holding. 2 days later, the Israeli Defence Forces, the IDF, were in operation again, this time in the occupied West Bank. Today, speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Israeli calls to formally annex part or all of the occupied West Bank and Gaza were mistaken. He said there was a realistic alternative which could benefit both Palestinians and Israelis.
The next phase is leading to a situation of permanent ceasefire in Gaza and a situation in which a transition can be established in Gaza, allowing for the reunification of occupied Palestinian territories and allowing for a serious negotiation of a political solution based on the two states. This is the win-win situation. But there is another possibility. And the other possibility is for Israel, feeling emboldened by the military successes that it has had, to think that this is the moment to do the annexation of the West Bank, to keep the Gaza in a kind of a limbo situation with an unclear form of governance. It is clear for me that Israel is not fundamentally interested in Gaza, it's fundamentally interested in the West Bank.
Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 10 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 40 injured in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin in what is described as a major assault. The IDF says it's acting to suppress armed groups, including Hamas, operating in Jenin, which is home to a refugee camp of approximately 10,000 people, about one-fifth of the city's population. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson sent this report from Jenin.
Tonight, on the outskirts of Jenin, a fresh battle between Israeli forces and Palestinian gunmen. This operation, described as large-scale and powerful by Israel's leaders, is now ending its second day, with soldiers controlling the entrance to Jenin's main hospital and many families trying to leave the refugee camp where armed groups are based. One man who left the camp today said residents were being separated by the army into groups of five and remotely checked by a military drone before being either arrested or allowed to leave. All the main roads into Jenin refugee camp have been closed off by the Israeli army. So we've come here to this smaller back road to try and see if we can get in. But the road into the camp has been completely churned up by the army bulldozers. And I can see at the end there are some Israeli army vehicles and some soldiers. And at least one of them has raised his weapon. It's not clear whether he's trying to get a better look at us or whether we just need to leave. As we were moving away, we spotted a family picking their way through the tangle of earth and concrete, one man lifting his infant son high above his head as he approached.
There are still a lot of people inside, elderly people, patients, kids. They couldn't leave. They're still inside. God help them. It's not normal for us this time. The strikes come everywhere. It's like Gaza.
Leaving with him, 52-year-old Kefa Sewal. I've lost 15 members of my family since the Gaza war began, she said. After what happened to Israel in Gaza, this is their reaction. They're taking it out on us. Israel's army shared footage of its troops detonating explosives and carrying out searches in the camp. Israel has carried out regular raids here since the 7th of October attacks to arrest suspects from armed Palestinian groups. But Israel's defense minister has talked about a shift in strategy for this operation. The goal not only to eliminate terrorists, as he put it, but prevent them from returning later. A key lesson from Gaza, he said. Israel is worried about the West Bank becoming the next focus for Iranian influence and arms. But a show of force here, after the ceasefire in Gaza, also plays well with those in Israel, who not only want to continue the war there, but want to annex the West Bank as well.
Lucy Williamson reporting. While Dalia Scheidlin is a political analyst and columnist for Haaretz newspaper in Israel. I asked her first if there is any evidence to justify the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres' concern that the occupied West Bank could be annexed.
Well, there's many things to support it, and they did not start with the operation in Jenin. This Israeli government has announced its intentions to annex the West Bank from the moment of its establishment in late December 2022, and it has undertaken numerous actions over the course of the year to advance that aim. After the war broke out, there was clearly a very, very strong fury at Palestinians in general and a strong incentive for the Israeli government to try to accelerate that process. With the war in the background as sort of an excuse and really from the Israeli government's perspective, a justification. And I think there were many things that have happened over the course of the year since the war began that also have accelerated the process, you know, including, for example, severe weakening of the Palestinian Authority even more than it already was, which, of course, contributed to continued unrest.
What justification are the Israeli Defense Forces offering for their decision to go into Jenin?
Well, they're saying on the immediate level that there was a ticking time bomb and these are serious terror threats. And the prime minister has also said this is all part of the Iranian axis, which is pretty much, you know, how he sees this entire war. It is very likely that there have been significant threats coming out of Jenin because that's one area where there are a number of Palestinian militant factions that are not really subordinate to the Palestinian Authority. But the other background is that there's been a severe escalation, again, of the kind of violence that we've seen both by settlers and by Palestinians against settlers.
Is there any expectation that the Israeli military will intervene to prevent violence by settlers against Palestinians?
Very little. In fact, what we've seen is that, first of all, many of the settlers are often in the army now or in reserve duties. And so they are, in many ways, blurring the lines between civilian settlers and the military itself. We've also seen that the Trump administration, one of the first things they did was cancel the sanctions from the Biden administration on individual settlers. And we saw the Israeli government decided to release unconditionally a number of Israeli settlers who had been held through the procedure called administrative detention. And so there is a very strong sense that the Israeli government is in a way emboldening the kind of violence from those settlers who have committed violence against Palestinians.
The Trump administration, as you say, has listed the sanctions that the Biden administration had imposed on these settlers. Has it expressed its view at all on what's happening in the West Bank?
If anything, the American government under Biden and now under Trump is very, very focused on Gaza. And as a result, I think that there's been far less attention to what's going on in the West Bank, and possibly even in an implicit way that allows the Israeli government to think it has a more free hand to do these things. And so I think that till the Trump administration has a real policy that is more comprehensive with relation to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict at large, I don't think we're seeing any serious constraints right now, certainly not if you look at the choice of the American ambassador to Israel, who is somebody who has openly supported Israel's complete control
this
over
the West Bank.
This is Mike Huckabee,
the former Mike Huckabee. American governor. Yeah.
Sure. And of course, now we also know that the American ambassador to the UN, Elise Stefanik, has also confirmed that she supports that as well. And so we see that there is an emerging position, at least from certain key personnel, that is permissive of Israel's annexationist intentions in the West Bank. But I think we can't completely depend on that because Trump himself is famously unpredictable and famously also has other regional interests that might involve stabilizing the region, that might involve a deal with Saudi Arabia for normalization with Israel, which would require some sort of restraint. It's all very, very much speculation right now, and I think we have to be extremely cautious. But I also would be extremely cautious about assuming that whatever President Trump does now over the next, you know, few days and few weeks holds for the future, because he is unpredictable, and he might develop a policy that involves pressuring Israel in ways that he did, for example, to get to the hostage release ceasefire deal in Gaza.
Political analyst Dalia Scheidlin on the Israeli military operation in Jenin in the occupied West Bank. War puts pressure on every part of a nation's governance. In Ukraine, fast approaching the third anniversary of the start of Russia's attempted invasion, hospitals are both understaffed and overcrowded. Such conditions make it hard to contain the spread of one of the main global health threats, antimicrobial resistance. It means patients die because drugs don't work. The BBC's Abdul-Jalil Abdurasulov has visited hospitals in Kyiv and Dnipro to learn how medical facilities are coping with these challenges.
In a spacious hall, two women wearing a wreath of flowers play the Ukrainian national instrument, the bandura. This is an initiation ceremony for young medics who recently joined the Mechnikov Hospital in Dnipro. To get new staff is a big relief for the hospital's administration. This facility, like most others across Ukraine, needs more people to deal with the biggest influx of patients since World War II. Dr. Volodymyr Dubina, the head of the intensive care unit at the Mechnikov Hospital, explains the threats they face.
When there is a massive influx, we will have a contamination with pathogens. When we have a contamination, it means we get hospital-acquired infections.
Dr. Dubina talks about antimicrobial resistance. That's when antibiotics and other medicine don't work. It's a global problem, but the war in Ukraine makes it much more challenging to contain its spread. Since the start of the Russian invasion, the number of beds in just one intensive care unit of the Mechnikov Hospital has tripled, while the number of staff has decreased. So maintaining sterile conditions has become much harder. And since evacuation of wounded soldiers involves several hospitals, dangerous pathogens spread even further. Today, more than 80% of patients admitted to a Feofania hospital in Kyiv have resistance to antibiotics. This is a recording of a surgery doctors did on one such patient, Private Alexander Bezverkhny, who was wounded a year ago. It's too shocking to describe his wounds, but treating his flesh ripped off by shrapnel would have been much easier had he not been infected with bacteria resistant to drugs. Because of this, Private Bezverkhny had sepsis 5 times. It's been so painful. I constantly called doctors at night, he says. Dr. Strokan, deputy chief physician at Feofania Hospital, says Alexander had more chances to die than live.
We've carried out more than 100 surgeries on him. And even at those stages, he got new infections. So what did we do? We did what every clinic should do. We isolated him.
But the Ukrainian hospitals seldom keep their critical patients in separate wards. Too many wounded and too little space. Patients mix and contaminate each other. To treat infections resistant to drugs, doctors prescribe antibiotics from what they call a reserve list. But the more they use them, the quicker the bacteria will adapt to those antibiotics. And when it happens, the reserved medication will become ineffective too.
The BBC's Abdul Jalil Abdurasulov. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Coming up later, we meet an advocate of unregulated rewilding by releasing wild animals into the environment.
The creatures that should be here aren't here because of what we did in the past. And now that we just don't need as many sheep or all the food in theory that, you know, where the landscape's going to produce, why can't we start to restore some of the lost creatures to it?
Our headlines on NewsHour. The State Department has confirmed that an immediate halt has been ordered to all refugee travel to the United States, leaving many people stranded around the world. Prince Harry has claimed a monumental victory in his legal battle in Britain against press intrusion into his private life. And the International Criminal Court is seeking an explanation from Italy after it unexpectedly freed a senior Libyan police official who'd been arrested on suspicion of crimes against humanity. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. More than a century after the end of the First World War, over 1,700 predominantly black South Africans who died during the conflict have received their first public memorial, indeed their first public acknowledgement. They weren't soldiers. South Africa did not permit non-whites to serve in the military. Instead, they were used to support the war effort on the front line in East Africa as porters, wagon drivers and railway workers, among other jobs. They often operated under fire and many died from enemy action. George Hay, the official historian from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, told me about the new memorial.
It is a series of 1,772 Eroko hardwood posts set in granite, spread across company gardens, and it's there to act as a site of remembrance and address past inequalities and commemoration by naming 1,772 men, each on one of those individual posts. So anyone who's familiar with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission sites that exist around the world will have a vision of what they typically look like, and this is very different.
And very different intentionally, because you wanted to have the option to expand the numbers if more information becomes available.
It is unusual for us to put a memorial to the missing, which is what this is. So these are men for whom we do not have a grave. It's unusual for us to provide an individual form for each of those people rather than to inscribe those names on a wall.
Now, these men were principally men doing manual jobs, some of them quite dirty, difficult, demanding jobs in support of the war effort. And I suppose there will be some people listening and say, well, aren't war memorials supposed to be for those who fought and died in war?
I would simply say context is essential. They fought and they worked and they contributed in a way that made the war, particularly the war in East Africa, possible.
And yeah, it's important to remember, isn't it, that the First World War was a global war. It was fought in many parts of the globe because the European powers had empires. And so presumably that's why East Africa wasn't a long way from the war front by any means.
No, not at all. When people think about the First World War, they associate it almost entirely with the Western Front, with battles and warfare that's taking place along, you know, static trench lines that exist in France and Belgium. At least 100 of the men named on this memorial were contributing and died during the campaign in German Southwest Africa, what's now Namibia. But the vast majority of these 1,772 men were fighting or contributing to the fighting in East Africa. To give you an idea of how significant labour was and how without it, it could not have been fought in those theatres, you have a very limited railway network. You have very few metal roads. If you want to service soldiers in the field and to enable them to fight, you have to use human porterage. And we know that both sides involved in that fighting, the British and the Germans, they raise in excess of 1 million people to do that for them. And it's those men who carry the burden of the war, and it's those men who suffer the worst. Just because you are fulfilling a labour or a carrier role, as we call these, that doesn't mean you're separate from the fighting. Mm-hmm. You are there, and there will be some of these men who are killed in the process of that fighting. But the biggest killer in East Africa, and this goes for soldiers and carriers, is disease. And malaria and dysentery are, above all else, the biggest dangers that face individuals during that fighting.
What reaction has there been from the descendants of these men?
It's helping to shift and change people's perceptions around what South African contributions to this war were. Because these men weren't commemorated at the time, they have, to some extent, been written out of the history. And I think the engagement we've had with some of the descendants has been fantastic. It's the closing of an unhealed wound.
That's George Hay, an historian at the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. One of Europe's biggest clothing stores has launched a fashion range designed for people who have disabilities. Primark's worked with Victoria Jenkins, a fashion designer whose Unhidden brand features what's called adaptive clothing. When we spoke earlier, Victoria gave me some examples what exactly that means.
Elasticated waistbands, or within the pockets there are buttonhole openings to pass tubes through rather than over. And there are seated options, so for wheelchair users, so like the garments are actually shaped to a seated position. There's magnetic fastenings, there are openings in a lot of the sleeves, there's no buttons anywhere. But we have just a variety of access openings so that you don't have to expose your body to access parts of your body if you need to, if you're going through medical treatment or for whatever reason need to access a bit of your body without exposing yourself.
We thought of these things particularly for women who were breastfeeding, didn't we, years ago. Why have we not thought of them with people with disabilities?
This is the thing. I do consider maternity wear to be like the initial adaptive, and we just sort of stopped. I think we didn't go any further is that traditionally people in retail and in jobs and in fashion, if you're disabled or chronic sick, you're not hired. So people don't consider it because then people are not in the room.
Let's talk about what your personal motivation is in this, because you have a very personal reason for wanting to be involved with this project, I think.
I do, yes. So I studied fashion design and graduated in 2008. and then went through my own personal journey with disability and sickness. And I had life-saving surgery in 2012. But it wasn't until 2016 I was on a hospital ward going through one of many surgical procedures. And it was somebody else. And she'd gone through ovarian cancer. And she just said to me, you know, she couldn't dress how she wanted to. She was stuck in sort of like T-shirts and jogging bottoms. You know, she couldn't go to a wedding, she couldn't go to a party. And when she said it to me, I was like, God, that's so obvious. So I was like, well, someone must be doing this. But this was, you know, 2016. And there were some people trying to address this need, but it wasn't from necessarily a fashion point of view. It was more from the people that were dressing the wearer rather than what the wearer might want to wear themselves.
So it was the convenience of the carer or maybe a partner as much as for the person who was going to be wearing the clothes.
Yeah, it was very functional, very medical, very hospitalised.
Now, this led you to found your own fashion brand specifically to try and address this.
Yes. And to be fair, like when I had that idea for Unhidden, I didn't have really any expectations. I just wanted to be able to dress people. But because I'm quite stubborn and tenacious, what's happened is, you know, I've ended up being an advocate for this.
And you make the points that this is a kind of worldwide need as well, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about a big proportion of the population now who have a disability. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer from a commercial point of view.
If we're ignoring temporary disability or the elderly, an age-related disability, it's everyone. I'm one of the 80% of people that acquire their disability. Mm. Anyone at any time could join this community.
Was it a hard sell?
Yeah, you know, I've been 8 years in the making for this, and I've made enough noise that Primark said, well, why don't we work together? Because my background was as a garment technologist, so literally how clothes are made, how they fit, how they're graded for mass production. But I also have a disability lens, and I've spent years speaking to the community and getting their feedback.
Tell me in this range what you're most proud of.
I think the menswear cargo pant, because there's so much built into it. For all the trousers, they have loops in the inside. So if somebody else is dressing you, they can help you get dressed without having to touch your skin. All the pockets have tube access. They're all elasticated. If you are an amputee, the hem opens up to your knee, so you can get into the trousers and then open them up to attach your prosthetic. And then we put a range of pockets on so that if you're a wheelchair user and you're sat down, you can still access all of the pockets without anything falling out.
Do you hope that other retailers will get the message?
Oh, it's my dream. No one shops in one shop. And, you know, my aesthetic might not be anybody else's. We should have choice.
I suppose the question that a lot of people listening who might want to buy something for themselves or for a loved one is it going to cost me more?
Off the top of my head, I think there's only two garments that cost £2 more. But no, Primark and Penneys were very committed to it wasn't going to cost the consumer more money.
That's Victoria Jenkins, designing clothes with people with disabilities in mind. This is NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. The passion for rewilding has generated a related and much riskier practice. A recent example occurred in Scotland, where four lynx were released into the Scottish Highlands. They were recaptured, but one of them subsequently died. They proved relatively easy to tempt in with food, since hunting in the wild was almost certainly alien to them. Our climate and environment editor, Justin Rowlands, has been to meet one of those who believes rare and even extinct species should be reintroduced, regardless of what the rules say.
Derek Gow has three lynx on his farm in Devon, a male and two females. They're beautiful golden-eyed creatures, about the size of a Labrador, but much sleeker and more muscular.
That is a dramatic cat, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
These cats are in a secure caged compound, but until a few hundred years ago, lynx roamed wild in the UK, and Gow believes they should do again.
You've got lynx. Did you release lynx into Scotland?
I did not release lynx in Scotland.
You consider doing that?
I think it'd be really difficult. And our cats would not be good candidate cats because they're so tame. The creatures that should be here aren't here because of what we did in the past. And now that we just don't need as many sheep or all the food in theory that, you know, where the landscape's going to produce, why can't we start to restore some of the lost creatures to it?
This is not
just a hobby. Derek Gow's 400-acre farm here in Devon has become a centre for breeding rare species. He employs 15 people, and while he may not have any plans to release his lynx into the wild anytime soon, this place has become a hub for other covert species reintroductions.
So, girl.
In a shed on the farm, some of his team are checking on the health of the hundreds of water voles they're breeding.
He's got very pretty teeth.
They pick up the rodents by their tails and pop them in cardboard snack tubes to be weighed.
110. So you've got some growing to do, my love.
Gow says he's released some 25,000 of this once common, now endangered species. His menagerie also includes polecats, Scottish wildcats and adders. Gow makes no bones about his plans to release some of these into the wild. Tom Bradshaw is president of the National Union of Farmers.
This is irresponsible. You don't know the damage that could be done. You don't know the financial impacts that could be caused. Where are the impact assessments? And in the event that we end up in a position where they need to be controlled, there is no ability to control those species. So I think it really is irresponsible.
Derek Gow is unrepentant.
Well, I'm making unilateral decisions, but those decisions are to release, I don't know, a lot of benign water vole. You know, I'm doing good things. I don't think I'm doing anything bad.
That is Justin Rowlatt talking to Derek Gow on his farm in Devon. This is NewsHour on the BBC World Service. NewsHour. This is NewsHour. The State Department in the United States has confirmed that all refugee travel to the United States has been halted in line with an executive order issued by President Donald Trump. The processing of asylum claims has also been suspended. Hundreds of Afghans, including relatives of those who worked for the US before its military withdrawal in 2021, among those left stranded at various locations around the world. They fear they'll be targeted by the Taliban if they return home. Well, Mr. Trump says his country lacks the ability to absorb large numbers of migrants and refugees. Let's go live now to our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman. Well, let's hear from our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman, who told me more about the executive order.
Well, the executive order was signed by President Trump on Monday, and what we have had today is the first signs that this is now being implemented by the State Department. So this affects something called the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program. This is a very large program which allows for up to 100,000 people, roughly, who are fleeing war or persecution to come to the United States every year. Now, this is very distinct from people who turn up at the U.S. land borders or manage to cross over the border, who then apply for asylum. These are refugees who have been registered as such by the United Nations and then go through a very stringent vetting program in the country that they have fled to allow them to go to a third country. So this is a sort of system that the UN uses to share out really the burden of countries taking refugees. Now, the United States, as I say, was taking around 100,000 per year under this program. It's been completely suspended now by President Trump. And what they have said is anyone that even had a flight scheduled in the next week will not be accepted. So, you know, that affects, for example, up to 1,600 Afghans who had assisted the U.S. military who now are being told they can't board those flights and are effectively stranded.
Is there a possibility of legal challenges to this policy? I mean, presumably it's not going to be challenged in Congress, where the Republicans control both houses, and indeed where many congressmen and women will have campaigned on exactly this policy, like President Trump himself.
Well, it may be possible that organisations that assist some of these refugees, and there are programmes within the United States, including voluntary fundraising programmes, to give additional support to these refugees in the US. I imagine it's likely that those groups may attempt forms of legal challenge. It obviously gets harder for those currently in the countries they've fled to mount a legal challenge because they might not have the resources to do so. As I think we are going to see across the board, really, when it comes to a number of the measures to crack down on immigration, many of those will, of course, be open to legal challenge.
That's the BBC State Department correspondent Tom Bateman. Well, let's talk about the implication of this with Halima Wali, who is co-founder of the advocacy group Afghans for a Better Tomorrow in the US. She also has relatives still in Afghanistan. Some of her relatives fled to nearby Pakistan. Halima Wali, thank you very much for being with us. First thing I have to ask you is your reaction to the decision to suspend the US refugee admissions program.
Thank you so much for having me. Well, my reaction is certainly one of shock. I think a lot of us were embracing or bracing for the worst with President Trump coming into office. But I don't know that we knew that it was going to happen so quickly, really on day one. It's shocking and really devastating, especially for family members that were waiting for a flight to come here.
What does it mean for your own family?
Well, I have some family in Pakistan that were going through the motions and going through the process of the USRAP program, the US Refugee Admissions Program. And, you know, they went through it for about 2 to 3 years. They went through the processing, the application, the interview, and they were approved. So they're ready to go and just were waiting for that flight. But unfortunately, with the program being suspended indefinitely and immediately, that all is now up in the air.
Presumably for those who, as you say, had flights booked because they'd already been approved, this is a particularly difficult issue. They may have kind of literally packed up their lives in preparation for this move. Your advocacy group, is there anything you can do to help? Will you, for example, look at the possibility of a court case?
We're certainly trying to examine the best way forward and figuring out what we can do. There's just so much uncertainty and really no clarity related to how that affects some other pathways that Afghans can take to come to the United States. So we're certainly going to be examining every way that we can to support folks.
Was this what you were expecting? Because a lot of the attention had been focused on those who try to enter the United States illegally or indeed already have done so without the documentation, some of them living there for years, rather than perhaps people who had gone through a formal process, had done the applications, and in the case of the people you're talking about, had already been given permission to come to the United States.
We certainly were thinking that with an incoming president, Trump presidency, a second term, we were thinking that the immigration policies were going to either mirror or be worse than the first time around. In 2017, Stephen Miller, essentially the architect behind President Trump's first presidency and immigration policy, essentially tried to make the special immigrant visa, which is the SIV program that a lot of Afghans had been utilizing to come to the United States. These are folks that had supported the United States in some capacity while in Afghanistan, tried to kill it completely. But instead, they made revisions to the program and essentially made the requirements very difficult for folks to meet. And so knowing what we knew from the first time around, we essentially were anticipating that the second time around was going to be much worse, given the political climate in the United States at this time.
The United States made certain promises to people who worked with it. How do you feel about those promises now?
It's certainly heartbreaking and devastating. The United States made so many promises to so many folks that put their lives on the line, put their lives in risk of that of their families in order to support the U.S. mission. And so I think the United States owes a huge debt to these folks who are now living in Taliban rule or living in other countries who, you know, are facing inhumane conditions. A lot of Afghan refugees in Pakistan are facing deportation. And so really the U.S. still owes a large debt to Afghans.
Halima Wali of the Afghans for a Better Tomorrow in the United States group. Thanks for talking to us on NewsHour. Well, since Colombia signed a peace deal with the rebel group FARC in 2016, Medellin, its second largest city, has become popular with tourists. Almost 1.5 million people visited, up from 200,000 in the space of 7 years. If you look on social media, you'll see it's become a particular group of young men known as the Passport Bros. They're mostly from the US, people seeking an improved lifestyle, which includes relationships with local women. Phoebe Hobson from BBC Trending has been looking at how the influx of the Passport Passport Bros is causing a headache for locals.
So Medellin is an amazing city. It's seriously a beautiful, beautiful place. A lot of nomads go.
Medellin has a year-long good climate and is known for its innovation and buzzing nightlife, making it popular with digital nomads, especially men. If you look on social media, you'll see one group of men promoting it as a particularly good place to visit. They're known as the Passport Bros. It's a broad movement, but there are some central themes. They are mostly young men from the United States who've sought a better life for themselves abroad, earning in dollars.
You know, you're just able to live in paradise with beautiful people and only spend a fraction of what you were in your hometown.
Austin is a 33-year-old Passport Bro influencer who encourages men to travel to places culturally different to what he calls the West, in a large part to improve their dating lives.
Any guy in the West can test this. You know, set your dating app location to not just Medellin, set it to someplace in Rio de Janeiro, set it to a place in the Philippines. Each of these places have beauty standards. You're immediately one in, I don't know, 500, one in 1,000. And that can get you attention.
Then you're going to help people learn English and you're going to learn about the culture and community of Colombia.
Austin's videos are full of bravado. He jokes around with women and explains how much further your money can go when taking a girl out on a date.
And in doing so, you're going to meet a beautiful Latina lady interested in learning English.
But we've seen dozens of videos from other Passport Bros that promote sex tourism. For example, one TikTok account appears to be secretly filming young women in the street. Ratio of women, the video reads, hashtag passport bro, hashtag hookup, hashtag working women. Sex work in Colombia is legal and is common in tourist areas. What's concerning people in the country is some foreign men are travelling to exploit underage girls. Jasmine Santa Alvarez is a professor at a local university. She's been studying how the arrival of young foreign men has changed the city.
Passport bros who come in groups, in teams, and when you see who's coming, the demography of who is on the street changes. We've seen lots of underage young Afro-Colombian girls and trans women who are here tonight, and they are meeting the demand of foreign men who are coming here.
Hola, Jenny, ¿cómo estás?
Jenny Jimenez from Acción Movimiento Corazón, a non-for-profit that raises awareness of sexual exploitation. She's concerned about this influx of foreign men.
Colombia está preparado para los turistas extranjeros.
Colombia was not ready for so many tourists. It's obvious when you see the tourists who has come to get to know the place and who has come to do harm. It's not family tourism here, it's male tourism. You'll see it in the street, 4, 5, 6 men walking by themselves. I call them hunters because they are hunting. It's not sustainable tourism. In the days of the cartel, the biggest prize was to be with a young virgin girl. And we still carry this. We can't have this be what people are coming here for. Colombia has to move forward.
In April last year, Medellin's mayor, Federico Gutierrez, banned prostitution in tourist areas after an American man was found in a hotel room with two underage local girls. The 36-year-old was held in police custody for 12 hours, but then left the country while officials investigated the case. Bali Ramirez is the president of the Sex Workers Union. She says the policies are targeting the wrong people and the emphasis should be put on those wanting to sexually exploit underage girls and not on adult sex workers.
El gobierno le falta más legislación.
The government isn't criminalizing those who are committing crimes, those tourists who are coming to exploit underage women. After the pandemic, the situation became obvious and got worse. We, as union, are completely against the exploitation of children and also sex trafficking. Us, sex workers, are not encouraging sexual exploitation, and as a union, we actually report when we see exploitation to authorities and we report hotels who are letting underage people in.
I asked Austin, whose Passport Bro videos do not promote prostitution, what he thought of those who do. He told us he hates what videos pushing prostitution have done to the Passport Bro movement. He also says that sexual exploitation of minors is sad and would welcome further policies to protect locals. Being a Passport Bro can also be dangerous. At the start of last year, the US issued a warning and advised its citizens to be cautious as criminal gangs have been using dating apps to drug and rob men after several men died.
That's Phoebe Hobson reporting from BBC Trending, talking about the phenomena, if you can call it that, of Colombia's Passport Bros, as they're known. You are listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. Now, Prince Harry, along with a British politician, have settled their court case against the UK arm of Rupert Murdoch's media empire. The publisher admitted unlawful activities over a 15-year period at its daily newspaper, The Sun. It will pay the prince more than $12 million. The paper's full and unequivocal apology covers the work of private investigators employed by its journalists. Newsgroup newspaper says that unlike at another newspaper which it eventually shut down, its employees at The Sun did not intercept anyone's voicemail. The apology to Prince Harry also acknowledged the company's intrusion into the private life of his late mother, Diana, Princess of Wales, who died in 1997. Speaking outside the High Court in London, David Sherborne, the Prince's lawyer, warned that those involved in illegal phone hacking remained in prominent positions.
Far from being relics of a distant past, many of those behind these unlawful practices remain firmly entrenched in senior positions today, both within News UK and other media outlets across the world, wielding editorial power and perpetuating the toxic culture in which they continue to thrive.
In a separate court case in 2023, Prince Harry settled hacking claims against a different media company, Mirror Group Newspapers. Last year, he told ITV, a UK broadcaster, that his action was a personal fight for justice.
This is a David versus Goliath situation. The Davids are the claimants, and the Goliath is this vast media enterprise. I'm trying to get justice for everybody.
Prince Harry speaking last year. Well, Rob Watson is the BBC's UK correspondent. I put to him that a statement on behalf of Prince Harry described this settlement as a momentous victory. Is it?
I think in part it is, yes, because what he's got is an apology from the newspaper group, from Rupert Murdoch's newspaper group, an admission that absolutely, yes, his private life was intruded on unfairly using unlawful means. I mean, it's not a complete success because the second allegation that he had made and that would have been tested in court was this idea of a cover-up that essentially, from Rupert Murdoch on down, senior executives knew exactly what was going on, these illegal, unlawful activities, and covered it up. But because this case has now been settled out of court, that claim, that second allegation, which the newspaper group has absolutely denied, even in its apology, that won't be tested.
There have been other claimants, many of them settled. Is it the end of the story, as News Group newspapers are saying, or could there be other ways in which this could continue to be an embarrassment for Mr. Murdoch's companies?
Well, as you say, Sean, certainly News Group newspapers have said and hope that that's what this is, a line after a vast amount of cases, over $1 billion in settlements, over 1,000 people of claims. I mean, I think the answer to your question is it rather depends, I think, on whether the police or Parliament take up the challenge basically put to them by Prince Harry and the Labour politician Lord Watson to say, hey, look, we've got this dossier, we've got this second serious allegation of a cover-up by senior executives, you should now go and reopen investigations into that. Now, whether the police will do that, whether Parliament will do that, Sean, we simply don't know.
Where does all this leave Prince Harry, the tabloid newspapers, what we call in this country the red tops, and the whole sorry saga of phone hacking and use of illegal methods to get stories?
Right. Well, I think it's a good day for Prince Harry, right, who's essentially been completely vindicated in his claim of unfair and illegal intrusion. So good news for him. I mean, as to the tabloids and big media company owners like Rupert Murdoch, I mean, their reputation took a massive hit when the scandal first emerged in 2006, 2011. And I think there's not much evidence, Sean, that they've ever recovered from that hit, at least here in the UK. I mean, whether this is the final twist in the story and the sort of techniques, well, given all the twists that we've had so far, you wouldn't rule out more.
That's the BBC's UK correspondent, Rob Watson. Given they spend their time kicking a ball around a muddy field, it's long been a cliche that footballers aren't very bright. However, a new study of professional players in Brazil and Sweden suggests quite the opposite. They're actually smarter than most of us, certainly smarter than the average person. Alfie Habershon explains.
You don't have to be a genius to run around and kick a ball. As the German manager Hans Meyer once said, in every squad there are five really stupid players. One of them would absolutely live under a bridge if he didn't play football. And when players do get in front of the camera, it can raise some eyebrows.
God, I'm over Scooby, honestly.
Let's see. Does Jack Grealish know where he's from? No, he doesn't.
No.
That's where you are. Problem is, that's like 80 miles out. Because
that's the Manchester City player Jack Grealish, unable to point out where he's from on a map of the UK. But have a listen to his teammate, Manuel Akanji, doing some mental arithmetic and see if you can keep up.
Multiplication is what I've seen you do really well. I've got a few that I've pulled out. So, 23 times 42?
966.
I mean, there you go. What was that, a second? how about this one then? Okay, 93 times 60.
5,580.
Well, a new study suggests that Akanji's quick thinking is part of a broader trend. It tested 200 professional players for different thinking skills and says they are not just smarter than the average person, but in the top 10%. Leonardo Bonetti from Oxford University is co-author of the research.
Football players had much higher executive functions, but also much higher working memory and ability of solving logical problems and planning in general.
And it's not just a few smart ones driving up the average. The study even goes as far to say that without being brainy, you wouldn't make it as a pro player.
We can essentially predict whether a football player is a football player with 97% of accuracy, suggesting that nearly all of the football players had this set of cognitive skills. It's very likely that if you don't have this set of cognitive skills, you wouldn't succeed.
As a fan myself, I've noticed that football has become more intellectual. It's hard to watch a match on TV without being confronted with pages of statistics and graphs. It's even caught the curiosity of the chess grandmaster Magnus Carlsen. Here he is speaking to the manager and former player, Pep Guardiola.
Both in chess and football, the important thing is to control the middle. If you control the middle, you control the pitch or the board. Often in chess also, you attack on one side, force the opponent to overload, and then you switch. And you have an advantage on the other side.
Now, Pep, you must be impressed with the insight from Magnus. That's nice. He's right.
For the rest of us, it's a hard pill to swallow. We know that footballers tend to be stronger, richer, even better looking. Perhaps it's now time to accept they're smarter too.
And one final one. 83 times 4.
332.
Swiss footballer Manuel Akanji proving he's on the ball with numbers too. And that was Alfie Habershon reporting. This has been News of Mail. Thank you so much for your company. It's been a real pleasure to have you on this programme. We are, of course, here every day of the week. We never miss, unlike certain footballers, although there is a nasty rumour going round that tomorrow's News Hour will be presented by a professional player.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt. For things to be different in the future.
to bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.